Now, beloved listeners, if you haven't thrown away all the masks you bought for COVID, you might like to go back to wearing them after this story, because we're going to talk about dust. An estimated 2 billion tonnes of dust are lifted into the Earth's atmosphere each year, and much of it from the dust bowls around the world's middle. I remember as a child watching the motes dance and shafts of sunlight in the early morning and wondered what happened to it when I breathed it in. And when you think about it, of course, there are 6 or 7 billion of us doing just that, 6 or 7 billion human Dysons. Now, all the different kinds that come from all sorts of places. Some dust is sadly toxic, the result of mining, some agriculture, and the nuclear fallout we've been discussing in recent programs. Some is quite normal results of, well, wear and tear. But where does it all come from? And what exactly is it? A researcher and writer, Jay Owen, says dust is simultaneously a symbol of time and decay and death, and also the residue of life. And the only thing that is certain is that it all ends up under your couch, or some of it under the bed. I'm delighted to welcome Jay to the program. As she spent a lot of time thinking about dust, she decided to write a book about it. It's called simply Dust, the Modern World in a Trillion Particles, published by Hachette, and we welcome her to the Little Wireless program. Jay, definitions first. Please, what constitutes a mote of dust?
Well, as you've just said, it really could be anything. And that's why it's such a fascinating and rich thing to write with. But I like to think of dust as just tiny flying particles. That's the only thing really defining what it is, that it's very, very, very small, under, you know, a sort of fraction of the size of a human hair in diameter. It's flying, started off one place and it's gone somewhere else, and it's solid. Beyond that, it really can be made of anything from, you know, the machine, human-made fabrics in our homes, to the mineral dust, which is, of course, most of the dust in the world.
So how much is there floating around at the moment?
Somewhere between about 10 and 35 million tonnes. Dust doesn't float around for very long. So over 5 billion tonnes are emitted every year. But it only does about 5 days' worth of flying before it tends to land and fall to Earth again. So it's this continuous cycle.
Okay, so let's start with the dust in modern day London, where you live. Tell us about Ella Kitty Debra.
Ella was a young girl living in the south of London, near the South Circular, which is a sort of large road motorway running through quite working class, poorer areas of London. And her home was just 25 metres away from this road. And when she started developing asthma, she started getting really severe asthma attacks that she'd be rushed to hospital, unable to breathe. Over a number of years, this worsened, and sadly, she died several years ago. She's significant because she's the first person in the UK to have air pollution listed as a cause of death on her death certificate. That it was the first time ever noted that somebody had been killed directly by air pollution. And her mother, Rosamund Kitty Debra, has been an extraordinary campaigner for air pollution, for recognising the harm it causes in London. You know, when I look out of my window at the moment, it seems reasonably clear. London doesn't have the smogs, the sort of 1950s and Victorian London. It's, you know, the sky is not black and sort of sulphurous, but the air is still dangerous. And just because it's invisible, just because the particles are very, very small, it becomes easy to forget them. And recognising that there's still a risk out there and that we need to clean up our air is the contribution her mother has been extraordinarily brave in making over the last decade.
Now, apart from the dust dancing in the air, I understand it also dances in the underground railway, in the tube.
It very much does. London's underground is rather filthy. The little tube mice that live on there are not normally mouse-coloured, but a rather dark shade of black. The dust on the tube comes particularly from tube lines themselves and the trains braking and stopping, starting and stopping all over the course of the day. It becomes a fire risk. It becomes a hazard. And London Underground have an entire team of people trying to clean the tube up. You know, nonetheless, the air quality down there can be worse on the roads outside. You know, you think you're protecting your lungs by staying away from the roads and the streets, but really there's unfortunately just as much.
Well, back to the streets where road dust is a real issue, isn't it? The dust that's generated from the friction between car tyres and the road surface.
Absolutely. And it is a tricky one to treat. You know, we've made great strides in cleaning up the emissions from cars' engines themselves, but there's friction between tyres and roads. That's kind of how cars work. There's friction between on brakes. That friction is how cars slow down. And even regenerative braking and things on electric cars, they still pollute in this way. It's going to take a lot of clever science looking at materials to try and improve that.
Now, dust in the air causes more than issues with your lungs, doesn't it?
It does. The risk is because dust is so small, it's able to get inside our bodies and get inside deeply, not just into the lungs themselves, where it, you know, it irritates your alveoli, it causes in lung diseases, it causes cancers. But the tiniest particles, particularly those under 2.5 microns in size, can get into the bloodstream too. And from there, once they're in the blood, they can travel to every cell in the human body. You know, they can cause inflammation, cause irritation, causing heart disease, and also carries toxic particles, lead, arsenic, heavy metals like that, deep inside the body themselves, even into the brain. Terrifying to think about that. But it's being discovered that diseases such as Alzheimer's and dementias are potentially worsened by air pollution. You know, the air we breathe gets into every single particle of us. And where that air is bad, it does nobody any good.
I live in a part of Australia where the air is often thick with dust, rising in incredible amounts from the open-cut coal mines. Mining is one of the great culprits in this country.
No, very much so. And it's a kind of damage that doesn't get recognised. You know, it happens in rural places often. The people who are harmed are farmers or Indigenous people or, you know, a long way from the centres of power. And there's great environmental injustices across Australia, across America, all around the world, where there's significant sources of harm and not being recognised.
I'm talking to Jay Owen, who's the author of Dust, The Modern World in a Trillion Particles, published by Hachette. Now, when we talk about air in London, let's go back to compare it to how it was in, well, the 17th and 19th centuries, please, Jay.
The air in London got modern. This is the argument I make in the first chapter of my book. It got modern far earlier than anything else in the world. This started in the late 1500s when Queen Elizabeth I was on the throne and Britain started running out of trees. We chopped a lot of them down for the Spanish Armada to build ships for war, for general expansion. And there wasn't actually enough to burn for firewood. So Britain started using coal. It was the first place in the world to really start using coal in significant amounts, which it imported down from Newcastle in the north. And this was dirty coal. It was a stuff called sea coal, full of sulfur. And when it burnt, it stank. But each person in London was burning a ton a year for general household purposes, to keep warm, for brewing beer, for tanning leather, all the general industrial activities of the early modern city. And very, very quickly, the air filled up with smut and ash and smoke. London turned into what we sort of imagine as the industrial city of Lowry or of Turner, much later in Victorian era. London was actually like that by 1600. It was filthy. There were the Queen was being petitioned to clean up the air and expel all of the polluting industries. There were the first air pollution commissions, as we still have today, investigating the city menace.
I remember André Malraux, when he was de Gaulle's Minister for Culture, having a big spring clean of Paris, removing this sort of patination of dust that had formed such deep grime. And when something like this happened in London, it revealed that number 10 Downing Street had a dirty secret.
It was indeed that the building, we'd long thought it to be black, as you know, until probably the 90s or so, most of the Georgian traditional buildings in London were black, as soot and dirt over the decades and centuries had glued itself onto the brick. But they hosed Downing Street down properly as the air was getting cleaner, and they're like, oh dear, it's not black, it's kind of yellow. There's too much shock for the country to take, and so it got painted.
Let's go back in history. I understand that Seneca, writing in the first century Rome, was rather unhappy about dust.
Oh, indeed, talking about the soot from cooking fires and things like that, and even silver smelting from that period, from 2,500 years ago, the ash and the soot from that has landed all the way in the Greenland ice sheet. The air pollution from that long ago has travelled the world and stored itself in icy archives.
Tell me about John Evelyn.
Oh, I love John Evelyn. He's a little bit less known than Samuel Pepys, who's another diarist writing at the same time in the 17th century. These great learned men, you know, polymaths. Evelyn had written a book from everything from a sort of recipe book of salads to books on planting trees to great treatises on science back in the days when a smart person could still just about know everything. But he was particularly moved by London's filthy air and wrote a book called Fumifugium, on a treatise on London's terrible air and what precisely was to be done about it. It's an absolutely hilarious read. It's incredibly baroque. It's a wonderful turn of phrase, talking about the terrible impact the smoke is making, both indoors and out, on people's lungs and on his beautiful possessions, which are getting turned rather shady and filthy under London's air. And he lobbies the king to clean up the city, that thinks all of the sooty trades should be sent out east. Sent out and the city planted with trees and gardens to clear things up. You know, in this, he's really sort of quite ahead of his time. He was wrong to think that it was just the industry that was producing the dust. It was also London's homes. But that idea of tree planting, you know, is still something that London's councils are really pushing today as a means of improving there.
What a pity action wasn't taken along the lines Evelyn recommended.
Indeed, indeed.
You also recount the history of hygiene and the obsession with dusting.
Absolutely. And it's funny to think of, you know, cleanliness as something sort of socially constructed, right? Isn't it just sort of an objective fact? But if we look back, so medieval people weren't filthy. You know, they're not sort of living in squalor. But they didn't care about cleanliness in the same way that we do now. The idea that surfaces should be sort of perfect and sparkling. You know, dirt was a sign of a hard day's work and you keep your house orderly. But, you know, then event is just about okay. Dirt didn't necessarily carry this kind of moral weight. And it wasn't until really the Victorian era where dirt became this moral issue in the home, this sign of your virtue as a woman, as a housekeeper, and also a sign of your social class. And, you know, the Victorian city, as we have talked about, was filthy with all of the air from industry. And of course, everything outside comes into your home. But there's also increased awareness of health problems, of cholera in the 1840s and 1850s, of tuberculosis in the 1890s and 1900s. And TB in particular, people were afraid that it was transmitted in the dust, that the bacteria were in the dust, and the dust in the homes had to be improved. So you get this array of do-gooders, of philanthropic maternalists, of women whose sort of charity work was going into London's slums and educating people on how to clean, partly for very good practical benefit, but also as a kind of moralisation of taking these working class people and improving them.
So if cleanliness is next to godliness and women spend so much of their time furiously trying to get rid of dust, the vacuum cleaner must have seemed a very good idea.
If only it has. And, you know, of course, vacuum cleaning cuts down the amount of actual physical sweeping time people have to spend. But The problem was that standards of expected cleanliness rose to fill the time available. You know, God forbid women actually might get some time to do other things with their day. The moral panic of the sort of 1920s and 1930s, as these technologies became more available, was pushing for standards of cleanliness to get more important. You know, the expectation was to hoover daily, of elaborate cleaning routines, spending more and more time hoovering, brushing down your curtains, you know, using this gadget to achieve a state of cleanliness that had not yet previously been achieved. And so the workload stayed rather the same. It was just the standards that rose.
Jay, I think I'd like you to take me to California. We've talked about dust being formed in the absence of water, and nowhere was that more evident than in California. Tell me about the Owens Valley.
I would love to. So around 1900, Los Angeles faced a problem. The city was growing hugely fast and, you know, population doubling and doubling and doubling, but it was running out of water. It used all of the water from its local river sources and was having to look further afield to get the water the growing city needed. And exploring out 250 miles away to the northeast was this vast torrent of the Owens River, you know, alpine snow melt running lush through a desert valley with very low population. And so some enterprising men, William Mulholland, and goes to there and says, right, we're going to buy this valley up. And over the course of the 1910s and 1920s, they drain that valley dry. They build a canal that takes all of the water from this river and all of the 250 miles away to Los Angeles. Los Angeles has a very good time and grow, but in the Owens Valley, in this little valley up in the Eastern Sierra, is drained dry. It's turned to desert. A huge lake, the Owens Lake, 110 square miles, dries out to powder in just about 10 or 15 years. And it becomes, you know, dried lakes are a real risk for dust sources. They've got really, really fine sand and silt particles. And the Owens Lake turned into the biggest dust source in North America, possibly in the entire Western Hemisphere.
I'm talking to Jay Owens about her book, Dust, the Modern World in a Trillion Particles. Some listeners probably remembering the marvelous film Chinatown at this point. Now, what happened to reduce the dust coming from the Owens Lake? There was a bold initiative.
It was indeed, and it took an awful amount of lawyering and legal work to make even Los Angeles think they had to do anything. But finally, in 2000, after decades of lawsuits, Los Angeles Department of Water and Power was forced to fix the lake. What did they do? They took this empty pliers, sort of white, salt-covered surface, and started a massive engineering project, building, covering it in gravel, building a whole system of water pipes, returning some of the water to the lake with sort of shallow flooding, with salt works. It's the weirdest environment. When I've visited a number of times, and it's the least natural place on Earth. It's so artificial. It looks almost like a building site. But as soon as the water came back, so did the birds, so did nature, that as they travel up and down the Western Flyway each year, tens, hundreds of thousands of water birds saw a new sparkling patch of water, landed on it, and it's gone from being an environmental disaster zone to actually sort of site of quite special scientific interest, and it's one of the richest sources of water birds in the country.
Jay, the first grown-up book I ever read, and I was 13, was The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. And it radicalised me. It changed my life forever. And it's a significant document in our discussion, is it not? Because it tells the world, or told the world, about the Dust Bowl.
The Dust Bowl is one of the biggest environmental disasters of the 20th century, and I fear it gets forgotten now, that the scale of upheaval of, you know, dust storms carrying 350 million tons of dust, the sort of apocalyptic environment in the Great Plains of the United States in the 1930s. So Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, Nebraska. And it's just absolutely shocking. And it's driven by human activity and a drought, that It started because these lands had been grassland until after the Second World War became profitable to plant wheat. And so plant wheat people did, ploughing up the grassland, putting a crop on the land every single year to make a profit, whether or not the land could handle that. And so as drought comes, as it comes to the plains every so often, the rain stops, the temperatures rise, all the wheat dies, the wind blows, and the earth has already been ploughed up. There's no roots holding it in place. And so huge, huge dust storms swept the region for about sort of 5 to 8 years.
I didn't realise that it took the arrival of the dust in New York and Washington to get the president off his backside.
Oh, absolutely. It becomes hard to ignore something when there is sort of this orange light over, when you look out of the window. It can be genuinely apocalyptic. And we've seen similar things in New York and Washington recently with the forest fires. Again, a different type of particulates, of course. But the forest fires producing this eerie orange glow, and then suddenly it brings home that this is a disaster and that something needs to be done.
What is the current state of the areas that were abandoned in the 1930s? Oklahoma, Kansas?
Well, they're still depopulated, some of those regions. The population's never really recovered. But what they were able to do in the sort of 1950s, the after-war period, was starting pumping water from the Ogallala Aquifer. So there wasn't enough water for regular farming from regular rainfall and rivers. But by dipping into the sort of deep paleo water, the ancient water laid down tens and thousands of years ago, it still becomes a huge farming region, growing corn with cattle lots. But that water is running out. The time is very, very limited. Already in some places, that ancient water for thousands of years has been used up. It's impossible.
That happens with aquifers everywhere. That is their destiny and their doom.
It's just like fossil fuels, really. We're sort of benefiting for a short period of time on all of this ancient, chemical or water storage. And then it's gone, then it's used up. And then you've got a risk, really, of, you can barely farm on the high plains these days in 20 or 30 years. A lot more of that land really needs to be reclaimed, to return to prairie, bring back the bison. Some people are looking to do that and turn it back into the land it was, 150 years ago. That's what's sustainable out there, not farming.
But it's not just America generating dust. You also travelled to Uzbekistan, where another man-made disaster is generating a huge amount of dust.
Absolutely. I remember being a kid and looking at atlases and sort of looking, I was a nerd, I was a geography nerd, as you might be able to guess, but looking at the sequence of seas from the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, and the Aral Sea, these huge seas in Central Asia. But even at the time I was doing that in the 1990s, the Aral Sea had gone. There wasn't a sea there. This was a result of cotton farming under Soviets from about 1920s through to the 1970s. Continued push for increased cotton farming targets saw water being taken out of the Amudarya River. The river didn't stop running to the sea. And again, this is in quite a desert region. There's not a ton of rainfall to refill it. And so, lacking its water input, the sea just dried up, turned to salt, and again, a huge, huge air pollution and health risk for the people in the region. Now it's been, a lot of the base of the sea has been sort of recolonized by plants again. You'd almost never know there was water there once.
To what extent is climate change going to exacerbate the crisis?
Significantly, because of course, as the world gets hotter, we see increasing desertification and more areas losing their plant cover and becoming at risk of producing more dust. But dust does some funny things in the atmosphere, and it's a real cutting edge of climate science to work out how precisely dust impacts that. Some dust, pale dust, dust at certain points in the atmosphere, reflects sunlight back into space.
Finally, despite the fear that your book may, in fact, should give our dear listeners about dust, you also argue that dust is an integral part of Earth's metabolism, and indeed you cite an old friend of the programme's in James Lovelock.
Indeed. So dust does unexpected things, and it can sound from our discussions as though it's some sort of demon to be terrified of. But at the same time, it is natural. Sand in the Sahara in particular is a big source of dust, as you might imagine. And that dust goes on a journey and does interesting things. As it gets blown westward on the great trade winds, it falls out across the Atlantic Ocean and feeds the algae that produce the world's oxygen. The dust gives them the minerals they need to live and to thrive, the iron, the phosphorus that enable these tiny, tiny little plantlets to photosynthesize. Something like 50% of the world's oxygen is made in the oceans. It's, we'd like to think of it as trees, but actually it's happening far, far out to sea. And dust is an integral part of the cycle that enables those algae to thrive. Some of the dust gets blown even further to the Amazon, which is a strange ecosystem because it's so wet. Its mineral balance is uneven. All of its minerals wash out into the ocean. And so dust provides a source of essential minerals for the plants to survive, that the Amazon in South America is being kept alive by sources of dust from Africa. Everything's connected. And that's what I was told by every single climate scientist I spoke to, the aerosol scientists at NASA, indigenous people, activists, ecologists. Dust shows us that the world's all connected together, beautiful and intricate and interlocking ways. And I find that incredibly inspiring. I find it comforting in some ways to think there's such wonderful intricacy in our natural systems.
Sadly, we've run out of time, and I wanted to discuss one aspect of dust of considerable toxicity, and that's the ball dust infinitely produced by politicians, but perhaps on another occasion. Jay writes about dust in all its glory in her excellent book, including Nuclear Fallout, that we've spoken about many times on the program. Thank you for coming on the program, Jay. Jay Owens, writer and researcher, the author of Dust, The Modern World in a Trillion Particles, published by Hachette. And, beloved listeners, should you want to know more about dust here in Australia, Van Badham has made a series for The History Listen. It's called Dusted, about the human costs of mining, and you can find the series on the ABC Listen app. Thank you very much, Jay.
Thanks so much. Brilliant to talk to you.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.